Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, along with Pastor William Fink. We're going to continue our series on the Gospel of John. And we left off last time around John 5:30. And so let me just back right up to John 5:30. Repeat that before we move on. Let me see here. Let's see if there's, that's fine. John 5:30. I can of my own self do nothing as I hear I judge. My judgment is just because I seek not my own will, but the will of the Father, which has sent me. Now, of course, we're all supposed to do the Father's will, not whatever suits our theology at the present moment, right?
well, right. And we can only find the will of the Father. We can only find the will of Yahweh in the Old Testament.
Right.
At this
right.
point. When he says this, that there is no New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
We have to turn to the Old Testament to find the will of Yahweh.
Yeah.
And you know, the will of Yahweh is mentioned by both John and Paul many times.
Yes.
And I could, John 7:17, 9:31, Acts 22:14, Romans 2:18, 9:19, 1 John 5:14. That's only some of the mentions where it talks about doing the will of Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, they're all talking about the will of Yahweh as it's outlined in the Old Testament.
Of course, yeah. And wherever Paul mentions the, you know, old scriptures, which he does many times, that can't possibly be talking about his own writings. he's constantly quoting the Old Testament, so it can only be the Old Testament. Because there were no, as you just said, there were no other scriptures besides the Old Testament.
Right. There may have been, you know, bits and pieces of the Gospels as we know them may have existed, or mm-hmm. portions, or maybe perhaps Luke had already written his Gospel by the time Paul wrote his letters. But still, the scripture, that's the Gospel, the scriptures of the Old Testament, clearly.
That's right. That's
Paul
right.
writes to Timothy and he says, bring me books and parchments.
Right, right. Yeah, and I was just doing a word study because I'm still working on the exoneration of Paul and how he deals with the law. And I just was doing a word study on the word evil. And on the word evil, Paul is, he is very, very consistent saying over and over, do not evil, do not commit evil, do not do evil, okay? So how do these antinomians come up with, he doesn't believe in sin and there's no evil because the law has been abolished, you know?
Well, right, but evil isn't subjective.
Exactly.
Evil, sin is a violation of the law.
It's defined in the Old Testament, and that hasn't been changed. The only thing that's been changed is the sacrificial rituals. You know, and you know, so the antinomians want to generalize from the sacrificial rituals to everything you do, okay, and throw the Ten Commandments out the window, and everything else in the law out the window. You know, and that's just crazy.
Well, we should keep the Ten Commandments, and we should throw mainstream
pastors
out the window.
There
that's,
you go.
That's
going to happen one of these days too, for sure. Okay, verse 31. If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. So here's Yahshua telling us, folks, that he himself is only doing the will of Yahweh. Verse 32. There is another that bears witness of me. And I know that the witness of which he witnesses of me is true. So the witness of the Father and of the Son of each other is true. There's no denying it. Verse 33.
Well, I see that as a reference to John, who he mentions next.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'm forgetting the context since I'm late in the chapter here. Verse 33. You sent to John, and he bore witness to the truth, but I received not testimony from man, but these things I say that you might be saved. Now, I might as well bring in this article by Jan DeBoer at this point, since it is talking about John. And this article is entitled, Who is Your King? By L.E. Jan DeBoer, who's he's not that well known, but he's an identity writer from Arkansas. And the context of the whole article is the House of Judah, and in particular the House of David, and how the House of David ended, of course, with Yahshua Messiah. Okay, so, but we have to also understand that that was not the end of the Davidic dynasty, not by any means, okay, because the Davidic dynasty had been transferred to Europe with the well, actually, even earlier with Zerah going west. Okay, with Zerah founding the Roman dynasty, the Trojan dynasty, and then Brutus, who was a son of Zerah, also migrated to Britain, founded the city of London. Okay. And basically founded the British dynasty there as well, okay? So we know that the House of Judah, through Zerah, founded the British kings and queens dynasty, okay?
And in my Trojan Romans pamphlet, I explain how all of the princes, all of the nations who were all traceable to the Phoenicians and the Danann Israelites,
mm-hmm.
These nations all received their princes from Trojan princes, their kings from Trojan princes.
Yes, yes.
So this idea of one family supplying monarchy to the white world is a very ancient idea.
Right, right.
And they didn't, you know, Trojan princes didn't supply their sons as kings to the Hittites.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, the Hittites
right.
had their own kings, and they were... There's inscriptional evidence that the Trojans were actually paying them taxes, you know, homage at one point.
Yes.
Because the Hittites were a great and mighty empire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's besides the point.
Yeah.
All of the Israelite tribes in the Mediterranean received their kings from the royal family of Troy.
Right, right. And didn't the Trojans or relatives of the Trojans send a letter to the House of Judah?
Well, that was the Spartan king.
The Spartans, okay.
Yeah, and that's in the second century, much later.
Right. So
I'm talking about the earliest,
right.
the earliest period, like the second millennium. You know, the late second millennium, that the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th centuries BC. This can be established from the Greek classics.
Right, right. But the Spartans are also descendants of the House of Zerah Judah.
Well, I would say that the Spartans were the descendants of the. Of the Dorian Greeks, who were probably of Manasseh.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But, so Manasseh, so they sent a letter to the House of Judah around 200 BC telling them, oh, well, we're your kinsmen. Okay.
Yes, they did.
Verify, and we'll find out in John 7:35 and also in James 1:1 that the kinsmen of the House of Judah, you know, which was focused in Judea, but they were actually living in throughout the Greco-Roman world, and they're not Jews; they're Israelites of the various tribes. Okay, and then of course the Prince of the Scarlet Thread was Zerah himself, because he was when the twins were being born, he stuck his hand out, and the midwife, thinking he'd be the first to be born, tied a scarlet thread around his wrist. Okay, but then. Lo and behold, he pulled his hand back in, and Phares was born first, okay? So between Phares and Zerah, there was a feud as to who was the rightful heir of the throne of David, okay, which became the throne of David later, right? And then who was the Prince of the Scarlet Thread? Where did he wind up? In Ireland.
Right. There was no room for him to rule in Palestine since Phares was actually born first.
Right. Right, that's why they had the feud, and the vast majority of the descendants of Zerah never came back to Judea. They didn't cross the Red Sea under the cloud. They were not part of the Exodus.
That's why Paul explains to the Romans who descended from Zerah Judah that they were the wild olive tree.
Right,
that
right.
had to be.
Yeah.
Drafted in. He didn't say that to anybody else.
That's right. That's
he
right.
never
yeah.
said that to any of the Greeks he wrote to or to the
yeah.
Galatians. And in fact, he told the Greeks, you know, he told the Dorian Greek Corinthians that that their fathers were in baptized with Moses in the cloud and the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And he told the Galatians, he told the Galatians that they also were descendants of Isaac.
Yeah.
According to the flesh, the sinful
right,
flesh.
Right. So they were definitely acceptable, and so the Joseph Scepter theory would have to exclude those people.
Well, right. Well, the Joseph Scepter theory is just made up by a bunch of total clowns that don't know anything about the Bible in its greater historical context.
Right. They can't explain any of this. Why would these people be acceptable at all? So they might as well just throw the Bible away.
Well, right. They do throw half the Bible away.
Right. Right. And then, you know, so in addition to this story, besides the Prince of the Scarlet Thread, who was Zerah, the story of Zedekiah's daughters, okay, and the bad figs, which you're getting closer, you know, to, well, it's 600 B.C., let's say, 600 B.C., and the Bible clearly defines the good figs as those of the house of Judah, those of the house of Judah who went to Babylon for their own good, okay? There's simply no doubt about this, that the, so according to the Joseph Scepter theory, they would still be bad figs. Okay.
Well, right, but Yahweh calls them good figs. And Jeremiah calls them good figs.
Yeah, and they're not of Joseph. They're
so
of
what
Judah.
We have here is basically some Jews that this Joseph Scepter theory, they are basically false witnesses. They are false accusers.
Right.
They're
yeah.
Jews. Whether or not they're Jewish by blood, they're Jewish by spirit. Because they're doing the same thing that the false accuser does.
Well, what the premise they begin with is false. Number one, they falsely assume that Judah himself was a Jew, which is what the Jews claim he is, okay? The Jews make the claim that they're of Judah. But they also claim to be of Israel.
Well,
so why do you believe one lie and accept the other? I mean, and reject the other? They're both lies.
Well, that's the dichotomy that's apparent in all of their thinking.
That's right. That's right. And so he talks about Jeconiah, and otherwise known as Keniah, where it says, write this man childless. He was not childless. That is a that's an idiom, meaning that his children would not inherit the throne anymore. That's what
right. They would have no more inheritance.
Would have no more inheritance, okay? And so he talks about Jehoiakim. He says Jehoiakim was not childless. He had Jehoiakim and other sons, but none of his sons, including Jehoiakim, prospered on the throne of David while ruling in Judah. Not only did Jehoiakim not prosper on the throne, but he lasted only 3 months and 10 days before Nebuchadnezzar took him captive to Babylon. And from that time, none of Jehoiakim's seed were on the throne of David in Judah, but were governors over the captive Judeans in Babylon. Okay? So they did not rule and they did not prosper in Judea. And of course, the whole house, how many people came back from Babylon? 42,000?
Well, it's a little more than 42,000, but there were about 42,000 in the initial return.
And
that was the major return, and there was an insignificant number compared to that that returned later, 1,500, 2,000, whatever.
Right. And then Jeremiah 33:17 says, David shall never want a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel. That's exactly what it says. Neither shall the priests of the Levites want a man before me to offer burnt offerings and to kindle meat offerings and to do sacrifice continually. Okay, so what he's saying here, what Janabur is saying here, is that the various kings of Judah shall never be without a priest to help them offer sacrifices. Okay, so this is an answer to the question, who was John the Baptist? Okay? And that's why I'm bringing this whole subject up. And he continues here. The first half of the above verse is constantly quoted by those who teach the British throne theory, and it certainly came true. The genealogy continued through Jehoiakim, Salathiel, Zerubbabel, down to Joseph, okay, Joseph, husband of Mary, the legal father of Yahshua, but not the physical father of Yeshua, okay? He continues here. But the second half of the verse is just as important. Each of these descendants of Jehoiakim had a priest of Levi with them. See Haggai 1:1, quote, and to Joshua the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and Haggai 1:14 and 2:2, wherever the rightful heir to the throne of David went, the high priest of Levi went also with him. This ended with the throne of David being given to Yahshua. We're talking about the throne in Judea only. We're not talking about the house of Zerah and even the house of Perez in Mesopotamia became the kings over the house of Israel too.
Well, right. And there was a tribe. I mean, I can't make a direct connection.
Uh-huh.
But Herodotus describes a tribe of Scythians who were called the royal Scythians.
Okay.
They were the royal tribe.
Yes.
So the Scythian Israelites of the dispersion had one tribe that was distinguished as being royal.
Yes. Okay, so they had to be of Judah.
Now, it's demonstrable in the writings of the Middle Ages. I mean, like the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries, that even at that time, the kings of Europe were claiming descent from the Trojans.
Yes.
Because they knew that was the only legitimate royal blood.
Right, and of course that goes back to Zara. Right. Exactly.
Now, one illustrious king who is demonstrably descended from Zara is Justinian.
Justinian?
Yes. Justinian was a Dardan from Illyria, as we're told by his court historian Procopius.
Wow. Very good. Okay. Well, let me continue here. Wherever the rightful heir to the throne of David went, the high priest of Levi went also. They were a team, okay? So this ended with the throne of David being given to Yahshua. We're only talking about Judea, locally in Judea here, with his high priest, John the Baptist, who offered Yahshua as the Lamb of God in the River Jordan. Who was this John the Baptist? Was he just some nut wearing camel's hair clothing and eating locusts and wild honey? By what authority did he baptize Yahshua? How did he get into the palace for the birthday party of the king of Herod the king, so-called king? And why did anyone pay attention to him at all? Was he just the voice of one crying in the wilderness that nobody knew who he was? Matthew 3:3. John the Baptist was of the house of Aaron and the son of a high priest named Zacharias of the course of Abia, Luke 1:5. John, therefore, became a high priest of Levi upon the day of his showing unto Israel, Luke 1:80. He fulfilled the covenant of peace given to the descendants of Aaron, Numbers 25:12, and had the authority to offer sacrifice, for example, baptize our Savior. This priesthood ended with the death of John the Baptist, who was the last Levitical priest. This is why killing him was so important to the Jews. So, thus saith Jandaber. Okay? So when we have John the Baptist being murdered by the Jews, they murdered our last high priest of Levi. And of course, Paul tells us there is now a new priesthood. Oh, actually, it's not a new priesthood. It says we fall back to the old priesthood of the order of Melchizedek, okay, which is simply the hereditary priesthood of the children of Israel, male.
Let me say that it's clear that John the Baptist's father was allowed to go into the Holy of Holies. And he had to be a high priest to do that, I believe.
Yes, absolutely.
To do it lawfully.
Only the
He went into the temple to offer the incense.
Yes.
And that's where he saw the vision.
Okay, yes. Yeah, and the Jews slew him too.
And yes, they did. And John the Baptist, being his
son,
would have inherited that position.
Exactly. So John the Baptist was the high priest of Israel at that time. Okay, fascinating.
Well, probably not de facto.
Right.
The de facto high priests that role was usurped by Herod.
Right, right. Yeah, but he was true.
Well, right. He was probably the lawful heir to that position.
That's right.
But
that's
not the de facto filler of the position.
Right, yeah.
By
Herod hated his guts. And, for him to go there at that time would have meant death anyway.
Right. But the Herod that usurped the high priesthood.
Yes.
What was, that's something that happened 60 years before John the Baptist came of age.
Right, right. But his father, Zacharias, was still offering sacrifices in the temple. We don't know when the last time was that he offered sacrifice in the temple. It's hard to say, okay?
Well, right. And I believe that where it says son of Barachias in the Gospel of Matthew, it does not say that in the witnessing Gospels, and I think that's an interpolation.
Okay.
And it is not in all of the oldest manuscripts, even though it is in some of the better ones. I still think that son of Barachias is an interpretation, is an interpolation by a scribe, and that Zacharias is actually, as some of the apocryphal books tell us, including the Protoevangelion of James, that is John the Baptist's father.
Oh, okay.
That they slew between the house and the altar.
Right, right. Yes, very good. Okay, so just to understand, you know, what's going on here, that the priesthood, John was in fact the last high priest of the house of Levi, and he definitely was not a descendant of Joseph. Okay, you have to, you cannot throw. There's virtually no verse in the Bible that you can retain if you adhere to the Joseph Scepter theory. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't work, folks. Okay. All right. So where did we leave off? Because we were talking about John, but I received not testimony from man. Let me just start
well,
with
well, that to me tells him that, you know, tells him that he's Yahweh. He doesn't have to receive testimony from men.
Mm-hmm.
All men have to receive testimony from other men.
Right. Right. Yeah. And,
and he's actually making a statement that he's above that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he's definitely proclaiming to be the deity. No doubt about that. All right. Verse 35. He was a burning and a shining light, and you were willing for a season to rejoice in his light. Again, talking about John. Verse 36. But I have greater witness than that of John, for the works which the Father has given me to finish, the same works that I do, bear witness of me that the Father has sent me. Verse 37, and the Father himself, which has sent me, has borne witness of me. You have neither heard his voice at any time, nor seen his shape. Okay, so certainly, Yahweh being spirit, no one really has seen that spirit. We have to be spirit in order to see that spirit. Okay, that's how I would interpret this. Okay, verse 38, and you.
I believe that if they believed, they would have seen his form,
mm-hmm.
because they were looking at it.
Right. Well, they were looking at the physical shape in his flesh. Yeah.
Well, right. Yeah, they were look. I mean, it's not possible for a man to see God.
Right. 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 Unless, well, in the book of Revelation it says we shall see his face, but
that's his presence, or you know, that's
right.
That word right. does not mean necessarily literally the
right.
The face that's the skin stretched over.
Right, right. Not that he has eyes and a nose and a mouth. Yeah. But nevertheless, we shall see him as he is the other way of expressing it. I think that's also in Revelation. It might be in Matthew. I'm not sure where that is. But yeah, we shall see him as he is, in other words. Okay. As he exists in the spirit. Okay. And I praise Yahweh. I want to see that day. Okay. And that's only going to be for us, folks. No other people will see that. Okay, verse 38, and you have not heard his, and you have not his word abiding in you, for whom he has sent him you believe not. Okay, let me go back here. Is this John 6, is this being addressed to Pharisees or to the people in general here? I forgot.
Well,
therefore the Jews sought the more to kill him. Yeah, so he's talking to the Pharisees here. Okay.
I imagine that it's mostly to the priestly class
yes.
and the Pharisees.
And of course, you know, it's true of unbelieving Judahites.
But there must be a lot of non-priests gathered around.
Yes, yeah, because he was always, you know, whenever he was addressing the Pharisees directly, there were always bunches of our people standing around as well. Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. And you have not his word abiding in you. Now he's definitely talking to the Jewish Pharisees here. For whom he has sent him you believe not. Search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and they are they which testify of me. Okay, so he's telling me, hey, I'm the one, you know, hey, John Hagee. These scriptures, these prophecies, they are talking about me. This is definitely a messianic prophecy right here.
Well, this is definitely him claiming to be Yahweh, because the writings testify only of Yahweh saving Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Or Yahweh suffering on behalf of Israel.
Yes.
And of Yahweh redeeming Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I could say, you know, Isaiah 44:6, thus saith Yahweh, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, Yahweh of hosts, I am the first and I am the last, and beside me there is no God.
Uh-huh.
John 20:28, and Thomas answered and said unto him, meaning Yahshua, my Lord and my God. That's
mm-hmm.
when Thomas realized the truth of the writings.
Yes.
And if Yahshua makes this claim that he's going to save Israel and that they would have life because of him, that then he must be the Yahweh back in Isaiah that's making these statements that he would do these things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's definitely saying he's the only God. Right. Yeah. Commander McBragg, Yahshua said he was Messiah many times. Yes, he did. And that's what we're finding out by by quoting all these scriptures. He did numerous times. It was not just once or twice. Okay, verse 40, and you will not come to me that you might, you will not come to me that you might have life. They don't want life. They're Jews. They want money.
Oh, right. Yeah, right. Here Yahshua has to be asserting that he is the and he never says, I'm the tree of life. He says, I'm the true vine, and you are the branches. But here he's asserting that he's the tree of life of Genesis 3:22.
Okay. Verse 41, I receive not honor from men.
Well, I receive not an opinion from men.
Oh, okay. Oh.
That word doxa, it could be honor in context, and it really means a supposition or an opinion or that which you think.
Okay.
Is its basic everyday use.
Yes, or praise.
Could be praise too, but it depends on the context. But when I translate it, I like every other word I translate, I try to seek out its everyday, most commonly perceived use.
Yes. Now, again, in verse 42, again, he's talking directly, face to face to these Jews, but I know you that you have not the love of God in you, okay? I mean, this whole Gospel of John is just one long excoriation of the Jews and their religion. That's why the mainstream pastors never quote from the book of John. Verse 43, I am come in my Father's name, and you receive me not. If another shall come in his own name, him you will receive. Now, this is the one verse that the Paul bashers love to shake in Paul's face.
Well, right. We're gonna talk about this verse at length.
Yeah,
and I have that same thing noted. The Paul bashers love to point this one out.
Right. Now let me just before you even get into this in depth, let me just say that we've discovered in our discussions about Paul's epistles, he never said that I come in my own name. Never. He never once said that. Okay, so that the right off the bat, that's a false accusation. Okay, there's a couple of instances where Paul says my gospel, okay, but he's saying, yeah, well, my gospel is the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay, he's not saying that it's my my gospel that I invented it. It's just I'm teaching the same thing that the Yahshua Messiah taught. That's all he meant by that, right?
Well, right, but there's more to this.
Okay.
There's more to this verse.
Okay, please
because
continue.
It's not talking about Paul at all.
Right.
And anybody who supposes that it's talking about Paul is a moron.
Okay, I agree.
It's not talking about anybody in particular.
Okay.
All right? The Greek words, Ian, is if perhaps another.
Okay.
And that word is allos, another. It's any other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's not any specific other.
Right.
And let me say something.
Okay.
This is, you know, when you interpret words like this, this is where it helps to study the whole Greek language.
Mm-hmm.
And not just the New Testament words.
Right,
even, there's a word that's even used in the New Testament.
Okay.
And the word is dyna. And it's Strong's number 1170. And it's used in Matthew 26:18 of a certain person that was not, for some reason, named.
Okay.
Okay?
I see.
Now, Dinah actually means, and I'll quote Liddell and Scott, such a one, a certain one who cannot or will not be named.
Mm-hmm.
Who the person using the word... So that means a certain other person.
Okay.
And if Christ was talking about Paul, as the Paul bashers claim,
yeah, they would have
Dinah would have been the perfect word to use.
Right. Right.
Because it means somebody specific is going to come in his name.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is not the same name, but it is somebody specific is what the word Dinah would mean.
Exactly.
Okay.
And this is the word allos. And allos means any other person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Any other.
Okay.
And the words, the verb here is subjunctive. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The verb is not indicative. He is not making a statement that another one is going to come.
Right. Well, there's the big if in front of it. Yes.
Well, right. And the poll-bashing idiots missed the if.
Right.
Okay? And this should be,
it's obvious.
Me.
It has to be Paul.
Yeah, right. And it just means anybody else who might come in their own name.
Right.
That's
exactly
what it means.
Exactly.
Okay? If perhaps another
like John Higgy
would come,
yeah.
Exactly. My translation says, if perhaps, I make it emphatic, if perhaps another would come,
mm-hmm.
and that's the verb is subjunctive,
mm-hmm.
in his own name,
mm-hmm.
him you would receive.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what he's, and it's not pointing to any particular person,
yeah.
but it has been demonstrated, as you're saying, a million times. People have followed after somebody who comes in his own name.
That's right. Well,
and Paul only came in the name of Christ.
Didn't he say repeatedly, many false prophets shall come in my name?
Right.
Not just one, many.
Exactly.
Yes.
And this is, all these modern day superstar pastors. But
there you go.
Whatever you want
to
call
them. They're all coming in
his
name.
They all come in their own name.
That's right. Well, they claim to come in his name, but, yeah, they're really coming in their own name because
right.
they're selling their own self-help books. They're selling their own versions of Scripture, which you have to believe their version and reject true Scripture, right? Okay? That's where we're at, folks.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this verse cannot be used in any circumstance to pretend that it points to any particular individual.
Right, right.
Because the verb is subjunctive. The EAN particle that precedes the word other means if perhaps or perhaps if or perhaps or if. Yeah, it's a very suppositional clause. It's if perhaps another might come or should
right.
come or would come in his own name.
Right,
it's talking about anybody who might come in the future in his own name.
Right. Well, I mean,
it doesn't even have to be a Christian.
Right. It can be anybody. Yeah.
Muhammad came in his own name.
Right.
I'm the great prophet. This is my book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's many examples.
Right.
Yeah. Jeffers, Dr. Jeffers.
Right.
Yeah, he's another clown
right.
that came in his own name.
Well, but emphatically here, though, isn't this simply saying that? You'll believe anybody but me.
That was an inside joke, by the way.
Yeah.
Right. That's what he's saying. You'll believe anybody but me.
That's right.
Is exactly what he's saying, and him you'll receive.
Yes. Yeah, because you hate me so much that you'll take some bum from a gutter before you'll take me. Okay.
Yeah.
That's
right.
That's
what he's saying.
Yeah. That's what he's saying. Really. Okay. Any further comments on this? Because you're pointing to the grammar here, and the grammar is very general.
Well, right. The grammar is very general, and it's not making a statement in fact,
yeah.
as the Paul-bashing clowns try to claim.
Right, right. Now, and it's true. Even the Pope. Now, the Popes originally came in the name of Jesus, okay? But then they proclaimed themselves to be infallible.
Well, right. This, they fit this perfectly.
Yes.
But they're not who he was talking about. They are an example of who he's talking about.
Exactly. Exactly. So we have many examples. Paul can certainly not be the one and only. Now, of course, now we have, let's briefly discuss the fact that Paul was a Pharisee. Okay. He definitely was a Pharisee. And the book of Acts tells us that he held the coats of those who were persecuting and killing the converted Judahites in Judea. Okay, so there's no doubt that that's true. Okay, so but we have to accept the scriptures as written. If there's a conversion experience, I beat you to it, McBragg. If there's a conversion experience. You know, again, it becomes a story of which verses do we accept and which verses do we throw away, you know. And my experience with the Holy Scriptures is they have always been accurate. The prophecies were 100% accurate. The history is 100% accurate. All of the archaeology that we see coming out today verifies everything the Bible has ever said historically and prophetically. So who are we to say, well, I don't like this verse because it speaks too nicely of Paul. Okay? Now, your thoughts on that, Bill?
Well, my thoughts is that when a man makes a prophecy and it comes true,
mm-hmm.
he's proven to be a man of God.
And
Paul made many prophecies that came true.
Yeah, yeah.
Romans 16:20. He
yeah.
told the Romans, Yahweh will crush Satan under your feet shortly.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't 12 years later that Jerusalem was destroyed and
right.
Satan was crushed under the feet of the Romans.
Yeah, and 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is one of the most powerful prophecies ever written. You know,
exactly. And
yeah.
and when a man makes a prophecy and it's fulfilled, we have to know that that came from Yahweh.
Yes.
And that's a specific, that's not anything general.
Yes.
That's a specific
yes.
prophecy. Paul told that high priest that accused him, Yahweh will smite you soon.
Mm-hmm.
And you could look it up in Josephus. That high priest was killed by robbers with his brother. Him and his brother were killed by robbers
mm-hmm.
outside the city in a sewer.
Right.
They were found dead in a sewer.
Okay.
And that's where all the Paul bashers are headed also.
That's right. That's right. Because what they're doing is they're letting their hatred of Paul dictate their understanding of the scriptures. Okay? And they've been led in this direction by the Jews. Because the earliest Paul basher that I had to deal with was constantly sending me quotations from Eisenman, Robert Eisenman. You know, he even sent me Eisenman's book. And so, Eli, you got to read this. So I started reading it and said, damn, there's not one word of truth in this book. You know, he does not identify Herod as an Edomite. He glosses over that. He makes all kinds of false statements equating Jews with the house of Judah and with Israelites. I mean, it's all garbage, total garbage. So, you know, I wrote back to him and said, how can you believe this stuff? This is a Jew writing this stuff. You tell
exactly.
me you don't believe in Jews. Now you're quoting Jews in order to hate Paul. When they're the ones who hate Paul.
My paper, William Fink versus the Paul Bashers, very very much proves beyond all doubt,
mm-hmm.
W.G. Finley, Clayton Douglas, all the other Paul Bashers get their doctrines and their beliefs straight from the Jews.
Right.
The Paul and that's why I say it, and I'm going to say it, the Paul Bashers are whoring themselves for the Jews.
Yeah.
That's because
right.
they're attacking Paul and dividing Christianity and destroying a part of the gospel, and that's exactly what the Jews want.
Yeah,
and
the
Paul
the
bashers
the
are the toilet paper of the Jews.
They're doing the work of the Jews, and they don't know it. That's just it. That's how crazy this is. They simply don't understand that they're being used by the Jews for everything they're worth. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no doubt. And they're playing, they may as well be Jews.
They may as well
put their little beanies on and go up
right.
to synagogue. That's where they belong.
And the Jews, really, they hate Paul. They absolutely hate Paul.
And they hate John.
Yes.
And after we
and
get
Jesus.
Rid of Paul, Luke has to go and Peter has to
right.
go.
Yeah.
Because they both testify of Paul.
Right.
And then they'll work on John because they hate
yeah.
John. And when you get down to it, all they'll have left is Matthew.
Right.
So, now, out of Matthew and maybe Mark, Troublemaker and the rest of the clowns that bash Judah will get rid of the first three or four chapters of those Gospels
because
they attest
that
Christ came from Judah.
Right.
When it's all said and done, we're not going to have a Gospel left
That's
because
right.
these clowns did the work of the Jews.
Right, right. So, you know, what, between the Paul bashers and the Joseph Scepter theory, you might as well throw the Bible away. Because there's
exactly.
nothing left that's true, according to them.
But the Paul bashers are Jews, and I wouldn't even have them here. I'm sorry. I just shut their disgusting
hopefully the passages we're discussing will illustrate the point. You know, the point being that
the Jews are behind this. Yeah, you know, there's 50,000 pages of documentation on my website,
okay.
and I've been challenging the bozos to read it for a year,
yeah,
and they won't go read anything.
They don't read, right?
Yeah, you know, they won't read anything.
They prefer their own opinion. Well, we just quoted that. I think it was verse 35 or so, somewhere up there, verse 33. You know, there is another that bears witness of me. We have to believe John. John bore witness, and we just found out that John was the high priest at the time. These scriptures are powerful, folks. You have to get them in the proper context. If you cannot determine correctly who is a Jew and who is a Judahite, then you will not understand these scriptures, and likewise, if you cannot determine correctly who is a Judahite or an Israelite versus a Jew, because the Jews also claim to be Israel. And that's a lie too, okay? So, let's continue here. Verse 44. Again, addressing the Pharisees to their face. How can you believe, which receive honor of one another? Isn't that what the Jews do? They're constantly giving each other Academy Awards and Nobel Peace Prizes and blah, 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 right? Seek honor from one another and seek not the honor that comes from God only. Mammon, they have their reward in this world. Verse 45, do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one that accuses you, even Moses, in whom you trust. And I think he's being sarcastic here, right?
Well, he's challenging them. That's the parable of the rich man and Lazarus.
Okay.
That if they would believe Moses, they would have him. That
right.
They would have believed him.
Right. That's what he says in verse 46.
Yeah, you know, Christ, he never told the Edomites, and he knew who they were in John
yes.
Attesta. He knew
right.
what was within man.
Yes.
Okay. He
yeah.
never told them, basically, that... He never spelled out that it wasn't possible for them to believe him.
Mm-hmm.
He said it, but he never really spelled it out. He always challenged them to believe him.
Well, I think the point is that they know he's the Messiah.
Well,
yes.
The demonstration is, yes, that they know
yeah.
what he is, they know who he is, and they can't believe him because they're the devil.
Well, yeah, not that they can't, because even the devil believes. Even the devil believes, but the devil has a different agenda, and
but, well,
must
right.
kill him.
Exactly, and they killed him because
right.
they can't believe his word.
Right.
They can believe who he is, and they have to act as the enemy acts.
Right, because they're the offspring of the devil. They're the offspring of the devil, and they cannot do anything besides which the devil wants them to do. Period. Okay, and so, but now this word. Let me repeat verse 45. Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one that accuses you, even Moses, okay, because they violate Deuteronomy 4:2, where in Deuteronomy 4:2 it says very clearly, you shall not add, you shall not subtract from the words that I have written, from the law as I have delivered it. And that's all the Jews do, is they come up with their own laws all the time. That's what Talmudism is. That's what Judaism is. Now, and it says, in whom you trust. That's the translation here in verse 45.
Well, that's in whom you trust, in whom you believe. It doesn't, it's basically the same word.
Okay.
And in my translation, it's in whom you have hope.
You have hoped. Okay. So hope is less definitive here because that doesn't mean that they believe. Because in that sense, it can be interpreted as who you use.
Well, we're in 545 in my Greek Bibles. In
yeah.
7.
So, I mean, that's why I'm saying, you know, it wouldn't be, I mean, if it was translated as trust, he'd either have to be sarcastic
The word is a verb, and it's elpizo.
Okay.
And it's, I don't have the strong numbers offhand because, I just read the Greek, but it's, elpizo means to hope.
Okay. All right. So to hope, so in other words, they hope. To use the words of Moses, they do not trust in them. Okay, so you know that's why you know there's a big distinction here. The word trust means you believe in them, and hope doesn't necessarily believe that. I mean, mean that. Okay, I don't know if that's too fine a distinction from the point of view of the Greek, but I would say that they certainly do not trust in the law of Moses. There's no way the Pharisees trust in the law of Moses. They corrupt it at every turn. Okay. Anyway, that's the point.
Well, they trusted in the law of Moses as far as they thought they were the seed of Abraham.
Right. Okay. That's good.
That's as far as it went.
Yeah.
And they confided in that.
And they were of Abraham through Esau.
well, yeah. A lot of them were. They were all of Abraham's seed, but a lot of them were of Abraham's seed through Esau. That is right,
right.
And that's spelled out in John chapter 8.
That's right.
And Paul spells it out in Romans chapter 9.
Okay, then we'll get into John chapter 8. Maybe not tonight, but definitely that. So we can definitely link this verse 5:45 to John chapter 8. Very good. Okay, so verse 6. For had you believed Moses, had you, for had you, underline the words had you, folks, for had you believed Moses, you would have believed me. For he wrote of me.
And the primary places where I believe he's referring to, as we have the scripture today, is Genesis 3:22, and this is quoted in the Acts of Christ, Deuteronomy 18:15-18, where it says, "And Yahweh God will raise up unto thee a prophet from the midst of thee, of thy brethren like unto me, unto him ye shall hearken."
Mm-hmm.
And the apostles in the Acts, you know, use that also in reference to Christ.
Yes, yes. Have a good question in the chat room. Does believe in the Hebrew also mean obey? Well, obviously, if you believe in the Ten Commandments, if you believe in the law of God, you would have to obey it, yeah.
Well, right, one follows the other, even though the word does not...
Yeah, they don't mean the same thing, yeah.
You know, you could tell me if you jump off that cliff, you're going to die.
Yeah.
I could still jump off the cliff, but I could believe you.
You're right.
You know, but if I want to die, then it doesn't matter.
But that's just the point of what happened to Eve in Genesis chapter 3, okay? Whether you commit an act of folly deliberately, and therefore deliberately sin, or whether someone tells you, no, if you jump off that cliff, you're not going to die. Yahweh's angels will catch you. Okay. Well, isn't that tempting Yahweh? Isn't that the same thing that the devil tried to do to Jesus in the desert?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the Jews get us to tempt Yahweh all the time today.
So there's a difference between, being believing and being stupid. Okay. you just don't tempt Yahweh. And the Old Testament is full of situations where the Israelites got their butts kicked because they acted at inopportune times, did not consult the high priest, did not consult the prophets, and took it upon themselves to try to implement justice according to their own thinking instead of to the thinking of Yahweh.
Well, okay. Look at what happened with the Benjaminites and the other 11 tribes.
Right.
And how horrible that turned out.
Right. And Benjamin and who was it? It wasn't Reuben. Levi. Yeah, Benjamin. No, it was Levi. What are the two tribes that took vengeance upon themselves to...
Well, they weren't tribes. They were individuals.
Right. At the time, they were individuals, yes.
That was Levi and Simeon.
Took it upon themselves to murder... take vengeance, put it that way. Take vengeance upon the men of the other tribe that raped Dinah.
The Canaanites of Shechem.
And so they did not consult Jacob. They just took it upon themselves. They did not consult their father. And
their curse was to be divided in Israel.
Yes.
And Levi was divided for a good reason, but Simeon just... sort of disappeared into the woodwork.
Well, yeah, Simeon basically got absorbed by Judah and also absorbed by Israel after the two houses split up. But Simeon actually had territory within the border of Judah, okay, and they totally got absorbed. But there was another part of Simeon that got absorbed by Israel as well. Yes, okay. All right, so verse 47, if you believe not his writings, okay, which implies that they don't. Okay, these Jews, these rabbis, do not believe in the writings of Moses, folks. That's what we're being told here.
They carried on the rituals and they took pride in the fact that they were Abraham's seed, even though it was usually the wrong seed.
Right. And so these scribes and Pharisees and Jews in general fulfill all of this, the scriptures where Paul is talking about. Just because you're circumcised doesn't mean you're saved. It doesn't even mean you're an Israelite. Okay? That's what Paul is really saying, folks. He's not saying in those verses that the law has been abolished. He's saying that circumcision by itself doesn't get you anything. Okay? It's just a ritual. Okay? Verse 47, the whole thing. But if you believe not his writings, how shall you believe my words? Okay? So, folks, this is why mainstream Judeo-Christianity is not like the Gospel of John, because, when was the last time Bill.
Well, they don't like it except for 3:16.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the only thing I ever, I mean, I don't go to church, don't get me wrong, but it's the only thing I ever hear, I've ever heard quoted from John my whole life. Yeah, you know, when you there's a lot of Catholic churches in Jersey where I grew up.
Okay.
And they would all have the big billboard outside, and they'd all have the Bible quote of the week.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I never saw anything from John except 3:16.
Right. Right. As I've been saying, they do not deal to any depth of discussion what's contained in the book of John, because he never quits bashing the Jews in this whole book. That's why, and you know, that's why they never preach any sermons about it, because they don't want to embarrass the God that they worship. Chapter 6. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great multitude followed him because they saw his miracles, which he did on them that were diseased. And Jesus went up into a mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. And the Passover, a feast of the Judeans, was near. And I think we touched on the subject briefly earlier in the previous show, that the Jews seem to be practicing a different calendar from that of the true Judahites of Judea. Okay. Verse 5, when Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw a great company to come to him, he says to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" And this he said to prove him, for he himself knew that what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 pennyworth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, says to him, there is a lad here which has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, but what are they among so many?
Now, before you get into this, I would just like to say that this Passover, which was coming, it's probably the third Passover of John's Gospel.
Okay.
That there's one at 2:13 and there's one probably at 5:1, most likely at 5:1, and one here at 6:4.
Yeah.
That's all I want to say.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, at this point I want to discuss these numbers because, as you know, I do a lot of study in the numbers that are put forth in the Bible. They always seem to have more significance than the face value that's being presented in the scriptures, okay?
Well, right, and I'm going to admit that I don't study them hardly at all.
Okay,
I hardly study the numerology of the Bible. I study the Word, and I know there's probably a lot to the numerology very often.
Yeah.
But it's not my topic.
Yeah, it goes back to the Hebrew letters, which were also used as numbers, and the same is true of the Greek, and the same is true of the Latin, that these letters also had numerical values, okay? And so
well that was in Latin, it was only some of the letters.
Yes.
Had a numerical value.
Right.
But in Hebrew and in Greek, the letters were the numbers.
Right.
I mean, the A written as a number, it would have a hash mark to the upper right of it, and that would mean 1.
Mm-hmm.
And if it had a hash mark to the lower right of it, then that would mean 1,000.
Okay.
I'm sorry, to the lower left of it. That would mean 1,000.
Yeah.
So and A and a B written together wouldn't be really written together. That would mean 3.
Okay. Yes. So B would be 2.
You
right?
know, B is 2 and G is 3 and D is 4 until you get to 9.
Mm-hmm.
And then the kappa is 10.
Yes.
And the mu is 20 and the nu, the n is 30 until you get to the let me get this right. Until you get to the letter before R and the R, I can't memorize the alphabet. The R is 100. The R is 100. So the first 10 letters, I'm sorry, the first 9 letters represented 1 through 9.
Okay.
And the next 9 letters represented 10 through 90.
Okay.
And the next 9 letters, there weren't 9 more letters, but the letters that were left represented from 100 to whatever, 800
sure.
or 900,
by, counting
or whatever,
by 100.
However high it went.
Right, right. Okay, very good. Yeah, so there's a lot of numerical symbolism, and if I use the word numerology, it's not what people practice today. It's simply the fact that these ancient languages had numbers associated to the words, okay? And that was very commonly understood in those days, okay? So here, what we're talking about in these 5 loaves and the 2 fishes It's not so apparent in terms of the five loaves, but in the sense it is, because loaves are leavened. Okay, we're talking about leavened bread here, that these five loaves represent the 5,000 years from Adam to Messiah. Okay, so from the first Adam to the last Adam, as Paul puts it, okay, or from the first, and then, the two fishes, the two Piscea, okay, so-called Piscean age, represent the age of Christendom, okay, the last 2,000 years that we're in now. So it represents a total of 7,000 years, the first 5,000 years being the age from Adam to Messiah, and the last 2,000 years representing the first advent to the second advent, okay? So I believe we're really close to that second advent.
Well, let me say that I'm going to be a little skeptical.
Okay.
And I'm going to say under the Septuagint, there actually had to have been like 5 4/10 loaves in the Septuagint chronology.
Yeah. But yeah, under the Septuagint, it's closer to 5,000 than the Masoretic, which is only 4,000, right?
But the Masoretic chronology is just it's just blatantly it's distorted. It was changed.
Yeah, and for those
Jews to fit some of their Kabbalah, which is numbers gone wild, and they actually reading their Kabbalah, they thought they had to change the dates of the ages of the patriarchs to pervert the chronology,
right?
To somehow prove that Yahshua wasn't the Christ,
right? They wanted to disrupt the timing, so they shortened the ages of the patriarchs, is what you're saying, right?
And then after they did that, they came up with the idea that the Messiah would come from Ephraim, because that's their idea. And Clifton proved that.
So
Clifton
that's Jewish too.
The Messiah comes from Ephraim, and Clifton's Ephraim Skepter heresy number 6. It comes straight from the Talmud, and the Ephraim Skepter people are whores for the Jews.
Let them have it, Bill. Let them have it. I didn't know that it came from the Jews.
So the Masoretic text dating is contorted, and then they try to make the Messiah come from Ephraim.
Right.
As it comes from the Talmud,
yes.
And that can be checked out, Clifton Emmaheiser's paper, The Ephraim Skepter Heresy, number 6.
Okay. And then
I just had to get that in there before.
Sure. And now, which paper did Clifton write about these the ages, comparing the Septuagint reckoning to the Masoretic reckoning, so people can figure that out, too?
Well, there are all the charts are on Clifton's website in a section called Chronology.
Okay.
And it's a paper called The Patriarchal Chronology.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And the charts are very, they're very demonstrative of the, you know, it's only common sense when you look at the Septuagint chronology in a chart and see that even though the lengths of the patriarchs were very, the lives of the patriarchs were very long, that they still waited much longer to have children.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
And there really weren't 10 or 11 of them alive at the same time.
Right, okay, yes.
And if you take the Masoretic chronology in a chart and you examine the lives of the patriarchs, well, when Abraham's born, Shem's still alive.
Okay, according
And there's
to
absolutely no basis for that in the Bible.
Okay, okay.
And by the Septuagint chronology,
right.
which is much, much more in line with history and archaeology.
Okay.
I mean, history and archaeology fall right into the Septuagint chronology.
Okay.
Well, Shem actually lived like 1,300 years, 1,200 years before Abraham was born.
Right.
When you see the charts that Clifton has on its site, it's very clear.
So this is one of the validated ways that we can prove that the Jews have tampered with the text.
Oh, absolutely, and an early Christian writer named Ephraim the Syrian actually recorded it.
Okay. Yeah, and numerous of the early church fathers accused the Jews of doing just that, okay? So that, we can validate there are certain words, certain ways, rather, in which the Jews have tampered with the texts, okay? But you can't go and just pick out this verse they tampered with because I don't like this verse. Or that verse they tampered with because I don't like that verse. If you have to prove that they tampered with these verses, okay? And the comparison of the Septuagint chronology versus the Masoretic chronology, plus all other kinds of witnesses, proves that that's how they tampered with it, okay? They also removed the name. They didn't remove the name of Yahweh from the Masoretic text. However, they influenced the translation of that into the King James and other English translations by removing Yahweh and replacing it with Lord. That's more Jewish influence, okay? So we can verify how the Jews influenced the translations, and, you know, we can prove how they did it. And we have many witnesses, but we can't just take one verse and say, well, this verse can't be right because I don't like it.
Okay. Well, everywhere in my writing where I eliminate a verse, and I don't have all of my notes up online, but where I eliminate a verse from the scripture, or where I change a word in a translation,
mm-hmm.
I give a detailed explanation as to why that should be.
Right.
And the explanation comes from secular lexicons
mm-hmm.
of the Greek language, from an exposition of Greek grammar,
mm-hmm.
and from the evidence in the oldest manuscripts.
Right.
And if I don't get it from those sources, I'm not changing one word.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's called scholarship. Right.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
That's called scholarship. Right. You have to give reasons why you justify changing a word or the meaning of a sentence. You can't
exactly.
just change it to suit your theory. You know?
And the manuscripts that have Christ descending from Judah, there's witnesses that go back to the second century of the validity of those manuscripts.
Right, right. Very good, very good. Okay, so...
There's not one shred of evidence that Christ came from Ephraim.
Mm-hmm. That's
except
exactly right.
For some of the verses where the Ephraim Scepter clowns confuse...
follow the Jews.
That they follow... Yeah, right. They confuse the genealogy... with geography and
right.
the word Ephrathite, which
right.
is a place.
Right, right.
It's a place which became known as Bethlehem after the children of Israel moved into
right,
the land.
Right, exactly, exactly. And so because they don't do really careful study, word study, geography study, history study, they can use words like that in an ill-conceived way and concoct a genealogy that has nothing to do with genealogy. That's what you're saying, right? Yeah. Okay. Now, going back to the second part of this verse, where we talk about the two fishes, I'm going to go back to the book of Hosea chapter 6, and I'm going to read all the way through 7:2. Come and let us return unto Yahweh, for he hath torn, and he will heal us. He hath smitten, and he will bind us. And, of course, he hath smitten us because we have disobeyed him, right? Verse 2, after 2 days will he revive us. Okay, now these 2 days can't be literal because we have, you know, there's no instance in our individual or collective experience where after 2 days our people have been revived, okay?
So this is a day to Yahweh is 1,000 years.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, so if we go back now to John 6, 6:9 here, we're talking about these two small fishes, and we get the picture here. In the third day, he will raise us up.
Well, right. So we've got no less. I'm sorry. Well, we have no more than 990 years to wait.
Right. Okay. So, but he said that those days will be shortened. Okay.
Yeah, well,
so the shorter the better, right? It says in the third day. It doesn't say the end of the third day or the middle of the third day. Sometime in the third day, and we know that those days shall be shortened for us, okay? So verse 3, because all of this is pertinent to what our discussion today. Then shall we know if we follow on to know Yahweh, to know him. It's not just a matter of belief. How do you know? How do you get to know Yahweh? There's only one way. You obey his laws. That's the only way you can get to know Yahweh, folks. His going forth is prepared as the morning. And he shall come unto us as the rain, as the latter and the former rain unto the earth. What's the latter rain, Bill? Quiz time.
Well, the later rain and the former rain, it's the spirit upon the earth. That's
well, the latter rain is the Old Testament, I got it reversed.
Yeah.
Former rain is the Old Testament, latter rain is the New Testament.
We can interpret it that way.
Yeah, we can. Verse 4. Oh, now listen, folks. This is about Ephraim.
I wouldn't go with the speaking with in tongues thing anymore with the
Yeah, right.
But like some people try to say the latter rain.
Well, that right.
And a lot of people interpret the former rain as being the New Testament, you know, the apostolic time.
Okay, okay.
And the latter rain is being yet to come.
Right. But here, remember, we're putting ourselves in the context of when Hosea is writing. So what came before him would be the former rain. Okay, so maybe there's a new interpretation of that. But here, verse 4.
I'm sorry, it's from Joel and Hosea. They both mention it.
Yeah, okay. So, O Ephraim,
Jeremiah.
What shall I do unto thee? O Judah, what shall I do unto thee? So he's talking about Judah and Ephraim, folks. He does not treat them separately as if one were cursed and the other were not. In fact, if anything, it should be Ephraim is cursed because the Ephraimites were far worse race mixers than the Judahites were. O Judah, what shall I do unto thee? For your goodness is as a morning cloud, and as the early dew, it goeth away. Okay? He's talking to us. He's talking to us today, folks. Therefore have I hewed them by the prophets. I have slain them by the words of my mouth. Ephraim and Judah. He doesn't treat them separately. He doesn't treat them any differently. I have slain them by the words of my mouth, and thy judgments are as the light that goeth forth. For I desired mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than the burnt offerings. Study the scriptures, folks. He wants knowledge. He wants you to be knowledgeable. Verse 7. But they, like men, have transgressed the covenant. Oh, boy. There have they dealt treacherously against me, both Ephraim and Judah. Gilead is a city of them that work iniquity and is polluted with blood. Oh, man. He's accusing both of polluting their blood. Verse 9. And as troops of robbers wait for a man, so the company of priests murder in the way by consent, for they commit lewdness. I have seen a horrible thing in the house of Israel. There is the whoredom of Ephraim. Israel is defiled. Also Judah, he has sent an harvest for thee when I return the captivity of my people. Two more verses. Please indulge me, folks. Chapter 7, verse 1. When I would have healed Israel, then the iniquity of Ephraim was discovered and the wickedness of Samaria, for they commit falsehood, and the thief cometh in, and the troop of robbers spoileth without, and they consider not in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness. Now their own doings have beset them about. They are before my face. So anybody who wants to claim that the Ephraimites are somehow morally superior to the Judahites, you better read your scriptures.
Well, yeah, that's an absolutely ridiculous assumption.
Yes.
Ephraim is a cake half-turned.
That's
what's
right.
The cake half turned, but black on one side?
Right.
I mean, that,
get
that's
your
a
black
serious problem.
Out of here. Right.
That's a serious problem.
That's right. That is a serious problem.
And if you're half black, then
that's right.
You've got to disown half your family because half of you is a racist.
That's right. Just like Obama, right? Okay, like the saying goes, the current saying is, you know, I'm not prejudiced. I hate both halves. Both sides of Obama. Okay. All right. Verse 10. And Jesus said, make the men sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down in number about 5,000. And there's that 5,000 again. Okay. Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to the disciples, and the disciples to them that were set down, and likewise of the fishes, as much as they would. And when they were filled, he said to his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost. Now, of course, this was a miraculous event. He created, you know, many thousands of loaves and fishes out of a mere 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Okay, and of course, that, you know, we're talking about Israelites here, too. Many, many thousands, as the prophecies say, of Israel, not and Judah, but not of the Jewish people, that the Israelites would be, you know, myriads of people, without number. Josephus himself confirms that. He says, beyond the Euphrates, there are so many Israelites that we can't count them all. Okay? And that no one ever says anything like that about the Jews. The Jews have always been a minority wherever they have gone. And they, in fact, they like to number their own people. There's always like 6 million dying.
Well, right.
Every so often, right?
Since you bring this up, let me make an exposition.
Okay.
Because it's Josephus,
mm-hmm.
the Judean.
Right, the Judean.
Who writes in his history that the children of Israel at his time
mm-hmm.
were beyond the Euphrates.
Right.
And he writes his Wars of the Judeans. He writes this in Aramaic to send it to the northern barbarians.
Mm-hmm.
And in Wars of the Judeans, he's writing Wars of the Judeans now.
Yes.
And he writes about a war between the Romans and the Alans.
Mm-hmm.
And the Alans are one of the tribes known as a Germanic tribe.
Right.
Now, why would Josephus include them
mm-hmm.
in his writing? And if it's in my paper...
Right.
Classical records and the origins of the Scythians, and I even, I'm sorry, I forget the whole title of my own paper, the Scythians and Parthians and something else.
Yeah.
But, well, anyway, I cite writings of Josephus who proves that the Scythians and the Parthians are the great multitude
mm-hmm.
of Israelites
right.
who Josephus says are beyond the Euphrates.
That's right. That's right.
So here we have Josephus,
the 10 tribes.
Josephus the Judean proves identity.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and if he were a Jew, that's the last thing he would want to do.
And the Paul-bashing clowns and the Ephraim Scepter clowns are also Josephus bashers.
Right, because, well, simply because they're fooled by the simple little trick that the Jews refer to him as a Jew, okay, and because the Jews refer to him as a Jew, he must be a Jew. Well, how many times are you going to believe that ridiculous lie? They say Jesus was a Jew, too. Okay? They accuse me of being a Jew.
Absolutely.
You know, so,
and they're just
right.
You're subverters.
Just because they accuse somebody of being a Jew doesn't make them a Jew. All right? It's as simple as that. When are they going to learn to stop falling for that trick? Okay, what were you going to say? Sorry.
Well, the Ephraim Scepter people, I've decided that they were subverters. They're not here to learn.
Okay,
they're
not well,
here
yeah,
to
I'm sure
they're
that
not
some
here
of
to
them
commune.
Are. Yeah.
They're here to subvert and to cause subversion. And we're really playing into their hands by addressing this.
Well,
but
also it does need to be explained because this is how the Jews have subverted Christianity in various ways.
Exactly.
By these word tricks.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the Ephraim Scepter idea starts in the Talmud.
And it's a word trick.
It starts right at the top. The fact that the it's in the Talmud that their Messiah would come from Ephraim, from Joseph.
Yeah, right.
And that's a Talmudic teaching.
Yes.
And Clifton proved it in his writing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're professing that, you're a follower of the Jews.
That's right.
And if you're a Paul basher, as I prove in William Fink versus the Paul bashers, you're a follower of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You're nothing but a Jew
yes.
troublemaker.
So you need to understand these scriptures. You need to make clear distinctions between the Jewish Edomites and Khazars and the people of the book who have no relationship whatsoever to the Jewish people. That's the foundational premise of Christian identity. That you understand the real difference between Jews and Israelites. If you don't know that, if you're confused about that issue, you cannot understand the scriptures. You cannot be Christian identity if you think that the Jews are Israel, like British Israel. They falsely teach that. Okay? Yes, there is a duel. Thank you, Mark. Okay. All right. Let's continue here. Verse 13, therefore they gathered them together and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves, which remained over and above to them that had eaten. Then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, this is of a truth, that prophet that should come into the world, referring back to Deuteronomy 18:18, again, another clear reference to the Messiah.
Well, yeah, when it says, it doesn't say a prophet come into the world.
Right.
It says the prophet. It's
right.
The article. And it could be translated that prophet.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this is the expected Messiah
right.
of Deuteronomy 18.
Right, right. Very good. Verse 15. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king. They want to do that to George Washington too, right? But the time
Well, this is the understanding, and a lot of people miss this,
mm-hmm.
the understanding that Yahweh would reign over Israel,
mm-hmm.
that his Christ would be the king to replace the line of earthly kings that's
right.
done nothing but get us in trouble.
Yes, he prophesied that. Yes, absolutely. But the time wasn't right yet, and we still had the 2,000 years after 2 days prophecy to wait for.
Well, right. And when you really examine the messianic prophecies of especially Zechariah,
mm-hmm.
where it says that Elijah will come,
mm-hmm.
and that's definitely a second advent prophecy.
Okay.
There are two clear advents if you examine that chapter in Zechariah.
Mm-hmm.
I forget which chapter it is. I think
right.
it's 12 or
right.
but,
12
but
or 14.
It's very clear that there's going to be a second advent.
Yes.
And that's the advent that Elijah precedes.
Right.
The spirit
right.
of Elijah precedes.
Yeah. And Jesus clearly says, "I will see you again." He definitely prophesied his own return.
Well, right,
times.
And that he was going to come the same way we saw him go.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, very good. So verse 15, when Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king because he was the legitimate heir to the throne. Not Herod. Okay, Herod was a usurper. He departed again into a mountain himself alone. Well, he couldn't allow that to happen because he would have been upsetting the prophetic timescale. Okay, verse 16. And when even now was come, his disciples went down to the sea and entered into a ship and went over the sea toward Capernaum. And it was now dark, and Jesus was not come to them. And the sea arose by reason of a great wind that blew. So when they had rowed about 25 or 30 furlongs, they see Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near to the ship, and they were afraid. But he says to them, "It is I, be not afraid." Then they willingly received him into the ship, and immediately the ship was at the land where they went. So this is this sounds like a miracle of time and space here.
Well, right, and let me say a couple of things. First,
okay.
Job 9:8, and Job speaking very poetically of Yahweh, and he says in 9:8, who alone spreads out the heavens and treads upon the waves of the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah, you know, the only place I could point to as being a prophecy of this event or anything like it is Job 9:8. And Psalm 107:28-31, that then they cry unto Yahweh in their trouble and he brings them out of their distress. He makes the storm a calm so that the waves thereof are still.
Mm-hmm.
Then are they glad because they be quiet, so he bringeth them unto their desired haven.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's definitely a
right.
a precursor to this event.
It's fulfilled in this verse.
Everything he does is almost as
yeah,
and outlined somewhere in the Old
right.
Testament.
And this, you know, brings up the question I occasionally visit rabbinical websites because I want to get their thinking on why do they reject Jesus as the Messiah. And typically their answer is, well, because he does not fulfill Jewish expectations. But he fulfills scriptural expectations. That's a tacit admission that their expectations aren't the same as the Bible.
First, right from Jump Street, Matthew chapter 2. You know, they heard the report of the Magi's, and the Magi's were jubilant. And all Jerusalem feared.
Yes.
All Jerusalem trembled.
Yeah, why would Jerusalem tremble if the Messiah has come?
And Herod immediately tried to kill him.
Yes.
So it's right before even knowing him. He's a little baby and they want to kill him.
Right.
And that's Revelation chapter 12. That's
mm-hmm.
what's told. I mean, Revelation chapter 12 is told after the fact, but it's
right.
a picture of what happened. That Satan, the great red dragon, which the Edomite Jews were, because they were in
right.
part descended
yeah.
from the Kenites and from Cain.
Yeah, red.
They tried to kill him.
Right. Esau means red, yes. The great red dragon. Exactly, exactly.
Half the people in the world, half the equation, is the serpent half of Genesis 3:15.
Mm-hmm.
Half the people in the world are naturally, genetically, and spiritually contrary to Yahshua and Yahweh
mm-hmm.
and his people.
Okay, very good. So we're seeing prophecy fulfilled time and time again, but the Jews deny it all because, you know, as we said earlier, they even have gone to great extremes to try to change the wording of the translations, and even, you know, they obviously changed the lifespans of the patriarchs to try to prevent the prophecy of Messiah being fulfilled so that they couldn't be interpreted properly, okay? It's nothing but distortion upon distortion upon distortion every time you turn around, okay? Verse 22, the day following when the people which stood on the other side of the sea saw that there was no other boat there save the one wherein his disciples were entered, and that Jesus went not with his disciples into the boat, but that his disciples were gone away alone. So this is what they, an account of what they saw from the other side. Verse 23, however, there came other boats from Tiberias near to the place where they did eat bread. After that, the Lord had given thanks. When the people therefore saw that Jesus was not there, neither his disciples, they also took shipping and came to Capernaum seeking for Jesus. So they all got in boats, like a, what do you call it when you have a fleet of boats, you know, coming for a celebration. They all got in their boats and went to the other side, okay? And when they had found him on the other side of the sea, they said to him, Rabbi, when came you here? How'd you get here? You know, we saw you in this ship, and all of a sudden, you just plain disappeared. Verse 26, Jesus answered them and said, verily, verily, I say to you, you seek me, not because you saw the miracles, but because you did eat of the loaves and were filled. Okay, so...
Well, don't use religion to fill your belly. That's the first
thing. Well, yeah, I mean, and, you know, again, you know, we're being told that our fleshly needs, well, first of all, our fleshly needs do need to be fulfilled. And, of course, getting back to the Sermon on the Mount, there's no way that Yahshua could have preached a sermon to 5,000 people, however many people it was, when their stomachs are growling, right? He had to feed them because, you know, you don't lecture to a hungry crowd, thirsty crowd, and expect them to comprehend what you're saying.
Okay. Well, right, but it's the same thing. You know, I want to call it a play on history.
Yeah.
Instead of a play on word.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
It's the same symbology,
right,
of Yahweh feeding the children of Israel in the desert.
Right, yeah. But now that their stomachs are full.
Right, but the people are in a spiritual desert.
Yeah,
and he's telling them to fill their spirits instead
of their
stomachs.
Now their stomachs are full, and they're grateful that he filled their stomachs, but they still don't have the spirit. That's what this verse means here. That's what I'm trying to get at. Okay, verse 27. Labor not for the meat which perishes, but for that meat which endures to everlasting life, which the Son, I have to turn the page here, of man shall give to you, for him has God the Father sealed. Okay, so now there is spiritual bread. Okay, there's literal bread and there's spiritual bread. And what we're being told here, and this is true of our people throughout history, that once they eat the physical bread and are satisfied, then they forget about the spiritual bread. Okay? And we have, and the churches are just as carnal. And what they do is they distort, especially the televangelists, they utterly distort the concept of spirituality to this gospel of personal salvation that, you know, that your belief will make you prosperous
in this
world.
They stop right here and they forget everything else he said.
Right. Right. They forget the real spirituality, which can only be gotten, as I quoted from the book of Hosea, to know Yahweh. There's only one way to know Yahweh. You can't know Yahweh by watching those whores on television. They're whores for the Jews. That's all
they
are.
They are. They're just like the Ephraim.
You have to know Yahweh, and there's only one way to know Yahweh. You have to read his word. And you have to understand it. Verse 28. Then said they to him, what shall we do that we might work the works of God? And Jesus answered and said to them, this is the work of God, that you believe on him whom he has sent. Now of course, they'll jump on this verse that only talks about belief.
And that's where they stopped.
Yeah.
That's where they stopped. They
mm-hmm.
stop right there. They forget.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, to believe on somebody whom Yahweh sent, you have to hear what he says.
That's right.
And adhere to everything he says.
See,
I mean, Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 6, in the opening verses,
yeah.
He says that good doctrine is every word of Yahshua Christ.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Every word.
Right, right.
Not just his name.
Exactly.
J-E-S-U-S. Every word. And
right.
To go through every
right.
word, you have to go through the entire gospel.
Yes, yes. And what modern Christianity has become, it's become an emotional roller coaster ride that you believe in Jesus. It's what is it really? It's idol worship. They've created this spiritual idol who is all of their hopes and dreams personified in a non-existent Jesus.
Well, it is a form of idol worship. That's
yeah,
exactly right.
That's what it is. They don't want to believe in the real Jesus who just preached the Sermon on the Mount.
And that's why the biggest image in Catholicism is the Virgin with a little baby.
Uh-huh.
They love the little baby Jesus. He's not going to tell them. He's not going to be mean and judge them and tell them what to do.
Yeah, he's not going to come back like the Grim Reaper.
They love the Virgin,
yeah.
And they love the little baby Jesus in the
right.
manger or
right.
in the arms of the Madonna or... They love that.
Yeah.
They hate the grown-up Yahshua.
Right. Exactly.
Who's the God
mature.
Of judgment. And
They can't stand mature Christianity. They want this feel-good, lovey-dovey, everything's all right, don't worry about a thing, gospel of personal gratification.
Well, exactly. And the adult Christ came not to bring peace but a sword.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, Paul was an absolute prophet. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, when he said, this whole people will become deluded and fall away from the true faith.
Well, right, and follow the Jews.
Yeah. That's prophecy. He was a prophet. That is one of the most profound prophecies in Scripture.
Well,
and it
yeah.
comes
he,
true to
Paul,
the left.
Paul in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 identifies the people sitting in the seat of Moses as Satan.
Yes. Yeah, right.
And that's perfectly true. And anybody with an ounce of sense who claims to know the identity message should know that Paul, and read my translation of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, it's crystal clear, Paul is true, and the Paul bashers are all fools.
Yeah, because they believe the lies of the Judeo-Christians that we've been discussing and their perversions of the Scripture rather than digging into the Scriptures thoroughly and really understanding. Okay?
Well, that's because they're a bunch of whores for John Spong and Jacqueline Prince. And you know,
yeah.
If you look at who the Paul bashers are, the prominent Paul bashers, who's that Irish, George Bernard Shaw,
oh.
Fabian
right.
socialist, in bed with a whole nest of vipers.
Right, right, right.
Okay, his best friends were all Jews.
Right, right. But again, let me just stress, because we only have a minute or so left, that even Thomas Jefferson was fooled, and Thomas Paine refused to accept the Holy Scriptures because he could not believe that the Jews were God's chosen people, okay? So these perversions of Scripture have caused many, many great men to go down the wrong path, okay? But for a good reason, because they could not accept the Jews being God's chosen people, because the Judeans, the true Judeans and the Israelites, are supposed to be a blessing to the world, not a curse. And the churches keep telling us that the Jews are a blessing. Okay? Show me. Show me one good thing the Jews have ever done in the history of the world. There isn't anything. Everything they do is evil. And so either the Scriptures are perverted or the interpretations are perverted. Okay? And so thank you, Bill, for helping me to prove that it's the interpretations and, of course, the translations that are perverted, okay? But when we say that, we have to prove, we have to demonstrate, because the premise that I've been working on, ever since I started writing Great Impersonation, is that the original Greek and original Hebrew are telling the truth, and you cannot always rely on the King James translation or any other translation, because those translations, number one, have an agenda, and it's real easy to figure out what the agenda is once you study it carefully.
You open up the Living Bible and you let 500,000 Haitians into the country.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and how they have perverted, but you don't get that perversion in the original Greek and the original Hebrew. It's just not there. Okay? And that's why the Holy Scriptures must be studied. You cannot take the translations at face value. You must study deeper. And I have to tell you, only identity people typically rely on concordance. You know, obviously they don't know Greek like you do, and they don't know Hebrew. Very few of us know Hebrew. But you've got the concordances. You can tell, you can check a word to see how it's being used in the scriptures and whether the translators are playing fast and loose with the, you know, a translation in a particular case. You know, it's actually very easy to discover that if you use a concordance, you know. And so nobody outside of Christian Identity does that. Absolutely nobody. And nobody outside of Christian Identity studies the history of these times like we're discussing. So they have a totally unhistorical view, and they have a totally ignorant view because they don't even do a word study. They don't even do that much. So, no, we're not talking about Eustace Mullins. Eustace Mullins is a good guy. he had a stroke recently, so we'll pray for his full recovery. I've been trying to get him on my show, but he's been hard to get a hold of because he's been traveling, and now I understand he's suffered a stroke.
Well,
so.
Well, Robert Balakaius put out a little mailing today that he suffered a stroke and he's on his way to Texas.
On his way to Texas?
That,
okay.
That his business partner's bringing him to Texas, and hopefully he'll get better treatment there.
Yeah, good, good. Okay, so on that note, let's conclude for today. Thank you, Bill, for, you know, this gospel with John is amazing stuff, folks. It's the most Jew-bashing document ever written. And we're going to continue next Friday with this Jew-bashing Gospel of John because it needs to be understood perfectly what's going on. Tomorrow we'll continue our series on 2 Corinthians. And then Sunday my show is going to be about telegony. So I'm sure you're going to, those two shows ought to be outstanding. And also tomorrow afternoon at 5 Eastern I'll be doing another show with Sword Brethren. So please tune into that as well. Okay? In the meantime, Yahweh bless everybody and thank you, Bill.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.